would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk and to present this this project. Sorry for the voice, I'm very sick. I hope I'm not gonna make you all sick with some Australian flu. But yeah, anyway, today I'm gonna talk about something that is in a very similar flavor to what Yuki just said. And so I already know what to expect from the audience. So, so I wanna, yeah, there you go. I want to just cite some of the collaborators that are part of this big project. Two of them are here in Canada, Rob Mann and Vikara Sain. I'm pretty sure that some of you know Danny Durno, Ian, who is at Macquarie University, and Ian Nagel is one of the PhD students. But I also want to sort of like thank some unaware contributors that are like with which we had quite a tight exchange of emails, and the insight actually allowed us to check corners of the problem that we were looking at. So, differently from what Yuki said, like I would like to take more of a foundational. What's going on?
It takes a while for some reason. I'm not sure.
Yeah. I would like to take more of a foundational approach to the problem of analyzing the collapse that results in a black hole and see what happens to the horizon in that case. So in particular, I would like to start just reminding about the fact that there are some paradoxes in quantum mechanics. And these paradoxes arises from the fact that we are trying to put some ingredients together that, in general, they may not talk to each other that well. I'm not talking about quantum gravity. I'm talking about the fact that sometimes we have some classical ideas and results, and we have some quantum features and results, and we try to combine, and in the past that happened, we try to combine it together and get a probability distribution that satisfies both the initial conditions. And many of you, I'm sure, know some of the paradoxes that are an outcome of that. And so we wonder if it's actually the information loss paradox is actually a paradox of that kind. Not just because there is paradox in the formulation of the problem, but because what happens is that, let's give it a second to switch. There you go. Yeah, I've already seen the slides. So what happens is that when we consider the formation of a black hole, so we have a collapse of matter, and that forms a black hole, we have, like, or at least when we study the semi-classical limit, what we have is that two kinds of ingredients. We have GR, and we have the horizons, and we have the mass error relations, we have classical trajectories, and so on. And in particular, we define the horizon as a classical concept that is like a sharp, like a locus of points that is sharp. But at the same time, we also want to use quantum field theory and the concept of radiation, so Hawking radiation and so on. So, singularly speaking, these two theories are, like if we take one theory, like quantum field theory and GR, they are unitary. Well, quantum field theory is unitary in the quantum mechanical way, and GR is unitary in the sense that one has a Hamiltonian formulations and they give an evolution and so on. But as we all know, when we try and put them together, we lose the unitarity. And of course, I mean, this is the paradox that I've been talking about for 40 years and more. And there is also a causality issue here. And the fact that if here we have two observers, and if you're familiar with quantum information, you know that they use Bob and Alice a lot. So Bob is actually the guy who travels on this trajectory, and he's like the inertial one, and it's far away. And Alice is the one that actually is like collapsed with matter. But from the point of view of Bob, what happens is that he sees that the collapse takes an infinite amount of time, but at the same time, he sees that, as you can say, that the radiation, the evaporation of the black hole takes a finite amount of time. So that is sort of like, let's say, I don't want to say a contradiction, but we are. It's something that it tells us that it is something that's not going the right way. So in particular, to analyze these problems that are like a hierarchy of models. And what I would like to focus today is mainly on, is mainly on the first two. So the idea is to try to understand how consistent this model, this description of the collapse of a black hole irradiation and the emission of radiation and the formation of horizon are in these two. And in particular, we want to analyze the causality issues that we want to use the causality issues that I just talked about, and the fact that from Bob's point of view, the collapse takes an infinite amount of time. Alice is the commoving observer, and so from her point of view, like the collapse takes a finite amount of time. But at the same time, the evaporation from Bob's point of view takes a finite amount of time as well, because the mass of the black hole is finite. So we thought of this as a way of like a case for the existence of pre-Hawking radiation, in the sense that to try and sort of like solve that causality issue, there are like two options. The first one is to use quantum effects, any exotic form or whatever, to say, okay, so the collapse is actually finite. Like these quantum effects are gonna change the metric in such a way that the collapse is gonna be finite. But that's like, I mean, the Hawking derivation doesn't include that at all. Or what we can postulate is actually that as soon as the matter collapsing gets close to the Schwarzschild radius, starts emitting radiation. So there is an overlap between collapse and radiation. And the emission of what we call pre-Hawking radiation is due to the fact that, like, it's due to the collapse of the matter, so the change in metric in that sense. And they can sort of, like, give an answer to that causality issue. So then it is something that hits in and changes the dynamics as we know it. So the other two, three delay seconds. Okay. So we consider, since we said that we want to use the semi-classical theory of gravity, what we use in our analysis, so the thing we want to check the consistency of, is we consider a classical space-time metric, so it's classical in NGR sense, and therefore we have concepts, as I said before, trajectories that are classical, or horizon that is classical and sharp, and singularity, and so on. And we also assume that, as I said just a slide before, that the collapse leads to emission of radiation, the pre-Hawking radiation. And since we are talking about a semi-classical theory of gravity, as Yuki said before, the Einstein equation is modified in this way. Like we consider the quantum effects that act on the metric that do it through the expectation value of the stress energy tensor. Okay, so I don't know why it's so slow. Anyway, so the goals, what we have tried to do with our analysis is to understand how, like, if the semi-classical theory is actually self-consistent, to see where the contradictions arises, and if there is a possibility of horizon avoidance, and consider it as a sign of some sort of inconsistency, more just say, like, that's the truth of the matter. And indeed, what we are considering the fact that in classical collapse, we know that we have horizon crossing because we consider a commoving observer that falls with, like, we have the crossing of the horizon in a proper time. We want to test the quantum affected horizon, so the quantum effects, how these are going to affect the horizon in a similar way. So, and for these reasons, we have considered massive shells. And the reason is that we can attach an observer to it. So we have a REST reference frame. Is it plugged in properly? Okay, so I'm gonna review a few things that maybe you, Yuki said, I'm pretty sure some of you know quite well, part of the audience maybe doesn't know that. So the big picture is the following. So we have a shell that is falling, it's massive and it's thin because we don't want, for now, to consider the internal structures. And Alice is sort of collapsing, it's sort of following the shell, so it's hovering above it. That way, it means that we can attach a reference frame that we can see there. And far away, we have Bob. And in general, the way this problem is treated is that we have an inside metric and an outside metric. Okay. That are described in this way. So inside, we have Minkowski structure. And outside, you can one can consider several metrics. In our cases, we have considered the Vigier metric, the first one. The second one is what we call retarder Schwarzschilds. I have some slides about it. Let's see how we are doing in time. And one thing is that the capital letters are the quantities that actually describe the dynamic of the shell itself. And how do I describe this dynamic? So there are two junction conditions that tell us, the first one tells us that the two, when I try to stitch together the two metrics at the shell, these need to like sort of coincide in a certain way. And they give us the result that the R coordinates is the same on both sides. But the most important is the second one. It tells us that the extrinsic curvature on both sides need to sort of satisfy this equation. This is the stress energy tensor for the shell. And this one is important because it gives us the equation of motion. So for now, I start showing you, as soon as you switch to the next slide. So we have done the analysis using different kind of metrics or generalizations. For now, I'm going to show you the Vigier metric because it's the simplest one and the result is neat. But if you want, we can discuss about other metric later. And so in particular, you have seen this before, this metric is defined that way. And so it's a generalization of the Schwarzschild metric where you have the mass that actually changes in time now. And the quantity half on the shell is defined that way. Remember that I said the capital letters are the quantities defined on the shell. So using the junction condition and so on, we got the full equation of motions that are defined this way. This B here is the one that is connected to, that it's basically the evaporating part. The dot is the derivative with respect to tau. Tau is the proper time of the shell. And U is, it's basically the coordinate U on the shell. So this is the derivative with respect to U. And these terms enclose the evaporation. This is going to take. This term here is going to appear in a second. It's basically the part of the equation of motions when you don't have the evaporation. OK, so this is more or less the mathematical settings. So what we have done, what we were interested in, it's understanding, I keep talking while I switch to the next slide. Yeah, there you go. No, it's still the same one. It's basically try to understand what happens when the shell gets very close to the horizon. So, and in particular, what what we have tried to do is to try to monitor this gap function here. So the difference between the shell coordinates and the Schwarzschild radius that is like shrinking as well. And so we have expressed the equation of motion in terms of the asymptotic terms when we get very, very close to the horizon. And we see that like the acceleration, like it's it gets really high and it's proportional to the fourth power of the velocity. I'm going to go back to it in a second. But in particular, what we have checked is basically the rate of approach of the shell to the Schwarzschild radius. And so, and this is what we have found. And basically, yeah, we have found this quantity epsilon star that sort of sets what's its natural scale, dependent on time, that is telling us, if we look at this equation, that basically, in order for the the gap to shrink, epsilon needs to be smaller than x. So what happens, dynamically speaking, is that the shell collapses and it gets very close to the horizon and it stays there. But it doesn't cross it. And so from Halley's point of view, what she sees is that the shell is collapsing, collapsing, and accelerating. But from Bob's point of view, he sees basically the shell collapsing and gets in very close to the horizon. And but as I said, we have that the acceleration gets really, really high and is proportional to the fourth power of the velocity. So that means that at some stage, and this is a result we have found recently, at some stage, what happens to the shell is that if it's not completely evaporated, what happens is that the shell becomes null. So its velocity gets in such a way that the shell transitions from to being a time-like shell into a null shell. And this is a result that they that Uru and collaborators point us to actually check, and that is the case also for our dynamics. But the thing is that what happens is that it stays null, and it doesn't go into tachyonic as Uru and collaborators said. So it stays null, and again we can check the rate of approach to the Schwarzschild radius, and we get a similar natural scale for to which the shell sort of gets to it. So what happens if the shell becomes null is that it gets very close to the horizon and it evaporates, and the transition from time-like to null happens outside of the horizon. And from this equation, basically what we have is that if we want the shell to cross the horizon to the stage, we have to switch off the emission of radiation that is encoded in this term. Okay. Since I have 3 minutes, 5 minutes? Okay. So what we have done is that we have checked the same, if we get the same result with a different metric. And what we have used is what we call the Retardes-Schwarzschild typo metric, where we basically used a similar concept to Linnet-Vickers potential. So basically, as you can see from this factor, and this, so C, by the way, is the mass, but I guess you'll figure it out. And basically, the metric that a particle sees in a certain instance is frozen, depending on the mass there was at the time the particle, the massless particle was emitted. And the equation of motion are actually very similar. So here it's true that the evaporation relation is at the time, at Bob's time of infinity, but it can actually be obtained for the time tau. So these are the two equations of motions when we consider the gap x, the gap that I introduced before. So basically when the shell gets very close to the horizon. And what we found is that we did some simulation with we solved it numerically with some initial conditions. And basically here what we found is the following. So from the point of view of Alice, as I said before, so this is epsilon star, the factor that I was talking about, that is more or less constant, and as the stage tends to increase. While Alice sees basically the shell accelerating, and we can see here the velocity tends to infinity. So what we have done, we went back to to Bob's points of view, and the two systems are related by this equation with the same the same initial data, And basically what we have here, it's a little bit hard to read, I guess. This is epsilon. The dotted line is the sheltered trajectory, and at some stage it stops here. And here, like the blue line here, is basically tracing this equation. And we see like an overlap between the two. It's a sort of like continuation that allows us to understand the dynamic of the shell beyond that point. And, and indeed, what we see here is that the two line basically, and this is in this bit, the two line basically, it goes down and overlaps again. Since I'm running out of time, I have three slides to summarize what I want to say. Let me move this before it falls. So what we have found in our case is that basically if we have two cases. So what happens is that like the shell collapses, it never crosses the horizon and it becomes null. And we have checked it in different cases. Like we checked it also for general symmetric metric, for arbitrary dimensions, and we also check the case when you have like shell collapsing on a core, so you have more than one shell, provided some conditions on the way the shell collapses. We also did some calculations for slowly rotating shells, and the results seems to hold. But we have some known unknowns, stuff that we want to address in the next future. And for instance, what happened to Alice? Alice is on a server, and we said that Alice is attached to the shell. So what happens to Alice when the shell becomes null? Is there any sort of mechanism in, for her to detach from it? And is the horizon generic, the horizon avoidance generic thing? Or like, can we find the specific metric that tells us that that's not gonna happen? What happens to trapped surfaces, for instance? Maybe we don't have a horizon, but we have trapped surfaces. Which stress sensors to use and so on. And what happens when we actually consider like the next level in the hierarchy of models. So the fact is that we consider this result more of as the like a sign that at least in the semi-classical theory, there is no information loss in the sense that if the horizon doesn't exist, the usual partition of in more and outside more and so on one can cannot be done. And we also want to consider this result as a way of checking the consistency of the semi-classical theory. In particular, there are some there's a paper by Brewston and so on that says like when we consider quantum effects, we may not the concept of a sharp horizon. It's not valid anymore. And when we found this result, we thought like, well, the epsilon is such a small scale, like it's a Planck scale, we're not gonna be able to observe it. So it means that us as distant observers, we're gonna see a black hole as, like we're gonna see this object as if it were like similar to a black hole in that sense. But actually, Vitor and then Paul actually contacted us and said like, there may be a way of checking if this is true, using the echoes and in gravitational waves. And in the end, there you go. In the end, I mean, this is not solving the problem, actually. This is saying like, oh, okay, maybe the paradox arises because in semi-classical theory, we're putting together concepts that are not supposed to be together. But so what happens to the description of the system? What do we do with, you know, the quantum correlations between the gravity, early modes, and late modes, and so on? What's going to happen to all the, you know, the thermodynamical properties that we have found about black holes and so on? And I conclude here because I went over time.
So is the picture that this thing gets null, it's presumably inward going null, I suppose, right? So that is the idea that the presumably the shell gets to goes to r equals zero, but the horizon recedes. I mean, the mass is dropping very fast, so the horizon, it never actually catches the horizon because, but it is going inward. So that, I mean, the shell really does collapse. And so I guess the main issue would be that what I think is very unrealistic, assuming this volumetric, because that doesn't, yeah. You know, fit with what.
Even though, and this is a result we got last week, I don't feel that comfortable talking about. So what happens is that when the shot becomes null, it sort of develops a pressure that it's what stops, like it is what prevents the shot from becoming like ionic. But at the same time, it could provide like another source of pressure that actually stops the collapse as well.
But in your model, it really does. In your model, it really does go to R equals zero, right?
Well, yeah.
It goes R equals zero, but the
it depends also on the evaporation and mass and so.
Mass
and
goes down, so never actually the horizon recedes ahead of it or something.
Yeah.
Well, so again, that's a big correction. If, you know, if you turn off Hawking radiation, as we know, the horizon is sort of the outward going null trajectory,
mm-hmm.
And the shell is the inward going null trajectory. So they cross.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So then, if you have a small correction, which say makes the horizon recede a little bit, then you know you wouldn't naively expect that changes the fact that they cross.
You
have a big correction.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Like, it's a, yeah. The fact is that two things. The first thing is that it's true that like if one considers the calculation for the stress energy tensor near the horizon,
yes.
One can say, well, it's not like enough to sustain the fact that the shell is not collapsing. But I think in this case it's slightly different. Like the shell is actually accelerating. Personally, I see it as a sign of something that is not like it's like we're doing a semi-classical theory and we say okay, so we have a stressed energy tensor, we normalize it and so on, and we see how big it is, but we are going in the other direction and we see like, okay, let's study the collapse and things are not like coming back together, like so I'm saying I see it more as a sign that the semi-classical picture that we want to use is not complete. Like there are factors that are not included,
yes.
And and this is like more of a symptom, like more of a sign. And I'm not saying like it's true, because it's one can consider from the physics point of view, like you have a stress energy tensor and so on. But if you consider like in terms of concepts, and you're like, oh, okay, so I have this collapsing thing, and at least from like the dynamics seems not to be able to collapse, to cross the horizon. So there is something missing.
Well, yeah, the comment I made to the first talk
yeah.
this morning is, you know, there is an analysis which is even more explicit, which you can do, say, in the 1+1 dimensional models, where you can explicitly
yeah.
find the quantum stress tensor,
yeah.
you know, feed that back into the 1+1 dimensional Einstein equations, and, you know, get a picture that, you know, sort of supports the traditional view that, you know, yeah, the horizon recedes a little, but infalling matter still crosses it, and, you know, then the black hole evaporates
yep.
later. So that's all supported, I think, at the level of, you know, equations, say in 1+1 dimensional models with a quantum stress tensor. And, you know, I think there are pretty good arguments that extends to higher dimensions. So the question is, what's going wrong? Or, you know, why is there a disagreement with them?
Well, that is a good point, exactly.
Well,
so.
It's a bidimetric. You assume the bidimetric is not at all like what
yes.
you calculate for the stress.
But there is also another thing. Like, if one tries and calculate, so as far as I remember, I may be wrong now, but when you calculate the stress energy tensor using a Lytton fingerside coordinate, it's like 1+1, you assume that, let me see if I can remember. You assume that this factor, I call it H, like the integrating factor. So we have du, dv. And well, we are in 1+1. You assume that this factor is 1, so this guy is 0. This is all the calculations that I've seen so far. Because we are actually checking the stress energy tensor as well.
Sorry, not in general, I don't think one does assume that. That conformal factor you get by solving the equations of motion, it may be initially one, but
yes.
you throw in any mass.
But what we found, like, depending on the coordinates that, like, the coordinate transformation that you do, that factor may not be one.
Can you dig it up in the description?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the thing that you're chasing here is the event horizon. So how are you locating the event horizon? In your model, how are you solving?
Well, one of the inventors is partial radius.
Meaning?
Meaning that it, the mathematical quantity.
It's zero of this function.
Yeah.
It's like,
inherent,
right? Yeah.
Not
the event. So it's defining what you're
saying. Okay, what I consider event horizon is that when it's crossed in a finite time, like that geometrical quantity, that becomes the event horizon. I don't know, maybe it's a distinction for me that it's not valid for others.
Well, we can have a discussion, but I just want to make a quick remark to what Steve said. I mean, the 1+1 case may not be indicative of what happens in higher dimensions.
That is also true.
It's transverse pressure, which you don't get in 1+1.
But
yeah.
3+1 is indicative, and in that, maybe not as exactly as he was doing in 1+1, but reasonably well.
So, yeah, I mean, with just what
I think Don's
I mean, there's a paper that we have in the archive, the Shorey Alp, where he even Christoph Salmis and I have, and we do the perturbation. We put in the calculations that people did in the stress tensor, and if the black hole, if the mass is very big compared to Planck units, it's just slowly changing, and we get these perturbative changes. And it looks just like the sort of standard picture with small changes that we calculated explicitly.
For certain states, which I would claim are special.
Well, it's assuming that you have the usual incoming state, and then you have all of
the unusual incoming state.
Yeah,
is the one that has that mild behavior.
Okay. So don't you say that like you?
A class of states.
Don't you say that you don't agree with the use of the bigeometry close to the horizon, like outside?
Yeah, that's what I mean, a better approximation is ingoing bigeometry with negative energy density. But there is this transverse pressure, which people have actually calculated, and it's not big. It's not big enough to do any of these effects, but it's a slot. It's not quite bigeometry, but
Okay.
Thanks.